Welcome to today's program. Before we get started with my interview with Radhanath Swami, I wanted to share just a few thoughts for all of us as we are now experiencing something we haven't experienced, at least in my lifetime, and that's the coronavirus that's affecting everybody in so many ways, not only health-wise, but also financially, the businesses that have that shut down. And now more than ever, we need each other. I wanted to share with you, first of all, something I posted on my Facebook page. We are living in uncertain times. We can respond in fear, or we can choose to meet uncertainty with love. We can be less concerned about hoarding hand sanitizers and toilet paper, and more concerned about sharing with others from our abundance. Ask your senior citizens if you can go shopping for them. Find out how you can help feed the precious children who are food challenged and will not receive a healthy lunch due to school closings. We can serve instead of sulk. We can rise in love together, one world, all sacred. Now, this will require a collective courage as we face the uncertainties together. My offering to you is this blessing for courage from John O'Donohue. And it's taken from his book, To Bless the Space Between Us, and it's on courage. John writes, "For the light around you lessens, and your thoughts darken until your body feels fear turn cold as a stone inside, when you find yourself bereft of any belief in yourself, and all you unknowingly leaned on has fallen, when one voice commands your whole heart, and it is raven dark, steady yourself, and see that it is your own thinking that darkens your world. Search, and you will find a diamond thought of light. Know that you are not alone, and that this darkness has purpose. Gradually it will school your eyes to find the one gift your life requires, hidden within this night corner. Invoke the learning of every suffering you've suffered. Close your eyes. Gather all the kindling about your heart to create one spark. That's all you need to nourish the flame that will cleanse the dark of its weight of festered fear. A new confidence will come alive to urge you toward higher ground, where your imagination will learn to engage difficulty as its most rewarding threshold." And I also wanted to share with you something out of Frank Ostateski's book, The Five Invitations. He's been a guest on this show and talked about this book, but there was a story in here that struck me, and I thought it was perfect for our time as well. And he was talking about a patient named Carl who was dealing with stomach cancer, and he was using a self-administered morphine pump that released prescribed amounts of pain medication to help with his stomach cancer, but it also left him foggy at times. And he thought he could use mindfulness to manage his abdominal pain instead of morphine. So he asked Frank to teach him how to medicate. And Frank agreed to try. And now here I'm just going to read the words from Frank Ostateski's book. "In meditation, pain is considered a great teacher. There are many different techniques for working with the experience. I began with the most common, encouraging Carl first to notice the pain by directing his attention to the general area of his body, then to precisely sense the tension, the sharpness, the sometimes searing, ever-changing sensations. He would alternate between this pinpointed, concentrated attention and coming back to the breath in order to stabilize and refresh so that his mind wouldn't become too exhausted. Carl was very determined. I noticed his furrowed brow and the tightness around his eyes. He was at war with this pain, enduring it rather than allowing, opening, or softening to the experience. He was trying to use mindfulness to conquer his pain, and he grew frustrated with the lack of immediate results. The pain was too much for him. He started screaming. We needed to find another way. So gently I laid my hands on Carl's belly, and this time I encouraged him to feel into the space between the center of the pain and the warmth of my hands. It still hurts too much, he groaned. I pulled my hands farther away from his belly. How's that? That's a bit better, he said. I pulled my hands out still more, encouraging him to soften the muscles around his stomach, relax his forehead, and let the pain float in the space he was discovering. Oh, that's better, he said. Now a little more, I suggested. My hands were 2 feet away from his body. Oh, that's lovely, he whispered. I wasn't doing energy healing work. There was no magic being performed. All that was happening was that Kara was making space for his pain. He was breathing easier now, and the muscles around his jaw had relaxed, and he lay back against the pillow, eyes closed. Can you just rest there? I wondered aloud. And Carl murmured, rest in love. You see, the words didn't come from me, but from some deep innate place within Carl. His awareness was now infused with love. He had found the reliable resource in love that he could draw from when he needed that. He didn't have to generate the love or do something special to make himself worthy of it. Love was already present in ample supply with him. From then on, whenever Carl felt overwhelmed by his pain, he would push his morphine pump and say to himself, rest in love, rest in love. And so my encouragement to you, dear friends, is when you start to feel panicked, when you start to feel great fear because of everything that's going on in society, start taking a few deep breaths. And like Carl, just say to yourself quietly and gently, rest in love, rest in love. And now here's my interview with Radhamaswamy. Welcome to Journey's Fire, a weekly program for the visionary and the passionate soul on a mission. I'm Richard Brendan, professional speaker, life purpose coach, counselor, and former hospice chaplain. My purpose in life is to inspire the fire that burns within you and reawaken your heart for love, life, and work. Each week I'll be bringing you engaging conversations with today's visionary leaders and social change artists. I believe that true fulfillment begins when we say yes to our dreams and take bold and inspired action to design the lives we are created for. Are you ready to live your best life? Well, Journey's Fire begins now. Radhanaswamy was born in Chicago in 1950. At age 19, he traveled overland from London to India, where he lived in Himalayan caves, learned yoga from revered masters, and eventually became a world-renowned spiritual leader in his own right. His acclaimed memoir, The Journey Home, has been translated into over 20 languages and published in over 40 countries worldwide. Radhanaswamy presently travels throughout Asia, Europe, and America, teaching devotional wisdom, but can often be found in Mumbai, where he works tirelessly to help develop communities, food distribution initiatives, missionary hospitals, schools, ashrams, emergency relief programs, and eco-friendly farms. His newest book is out, The Journey Within, Exploring the Path of Bhakti. It's a contemporary guide to yoga's ancient wisdom, and he's joining us from New York City. Radhanaswamy, welcome to the program.
It's my great honor and my great pleasure to be with you, Richard. Thank you.
Well, I have enjoyed your book and also your story, and it's a fascinating journey that you're on even now. I want to begin our time together by sharing a quote from your book. It's taken out of the introduction from your book, The Journey Within, and you write this, "All the twists I have taken in life have led me to a simple, ageless truth, one that sparked an incredible transformation in how I view life. All our countless desires, our insatiable longings, our fleeting gratifications, and our inevitable frustrations arise from a single origin. We have forgotten the love that lies dormant within us. Discovering and reawakening that love is our greatest need." This path that you're on as an internationally renowned Bhakti Yoga teacher, author, it started really when you were a kid, Jewish kid in Chicago. So how did you get from there to here?
I believe it was by a power beyond my own.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe that there's a power of grace that is always there to lift us up when we open our hearts to receive it.
Yeah.
And in my life, I was born in Chicago in 1950. And in the 1960s, I was a teenager. And during that time, I was involved in the civil rights movement and the counterculture, because there were serious issues that just disturbed myself and so many people in my generation. And we wanted to find answers. And, you know, through social activism, I found that I was helping in some way. But then when I looked into myself, I kind of resonated with what Gandhi said, that we should be the change we want to see in the world. And I really felt that that change was of a spiritual nature. So I began to study and explore various religions of the world, because there was a problem that I saw so much hate and division in the name of loving God, that either I had to reject the concept of religion, or I had to find an essence within all religions that had a universal principle that really brought about unity and love and goodness. And I really believed that that was there. And I began my search. I went to Europe when I was about 19 and ended up hitchhiking from London, studying Judaism and Christianity in Europe. And then I studied Islam through the Middle East. And ultimately, 6 months later, I ended up in India, and I was living in the Himalayas and traveling to various holy places. And if I didn't have any money during that time, but somehow or other, I just had so many transforming experiences. And ultimately, it was in India that I found this path of bhakti. Bhakti means, it means love, it means devotion, it means the spiritual love for God that's within the heart of every living being that we have a tendency to be so distracted from due to so many concerns, so many passions, so many fears of this world. And the journey within is really where our real home is, to reconnect with our own souls and with God's love, and to realize the potential that we have to find true spiritual joy and to share that in whatever we do.
What was it about bhakti that it felt like home for you, I think?
I believe that bhakti truly is the essence of so many of the great spiritual paths today. In the Bible, it is said that we should love God with all our heart, mind, and souls, and love our neighbor as ourself. And that is a definition of bhakti. Unselfish, unmotivated love. And the Srimad Bhagavatam tells that when you put water in the root of a tree, that water naturally extends to every flower and leaf and branch of the tree. And similarly, when we actually discover that love of God that's within our hearts, and we feel that love, then it manifests as compassion toward all living beings, because everyone is a part of God.
Yeah, the fact that we're all connected. And it seems to me, my experience has been, and then talking to many other people who've come on as guests to the show, that when an individual can have an awakening of sorts, I'll call it an awakening, and you leave that land of duality and enter into what Rumi called the field, I'll meet you in that field of non-duality, it seems like all of a sudden our eyes and our hearts open up and we see that we are all connected to one another, that we are connected to this Mother Earth that we live on.
The concept of yoga is harmony or unity. When we discover the unity of the body with the mind and live in harmony with our own souls, with our own living force.
Yeah.
And then then naturally we can see the harmony that we have with all other living beings, with God, and with Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the tendency to exploit, the tendency of, you know, to become arrogant or depressed, is transformed into a natural humility of honoring and respecting the inherent unity we have with everything and everyone.
Hmm.
And trying to bring that out in
yes.
ourselves and in other people.
That natural humility, which I believe is so necessary, seems to be so missing in today's leaders around the world. Would you agree? Is that your observation?
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
Much too often.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, you write in your book that once love between God and self is awakened, it flows naturally out into the world in the form of compassion for all beings, just as water is first absorbed by a tree's roots and then flows into every branch and leaf. And I know during 1971 in the mid-80s, you practiced Bhakti Yoga in a variety of settings, didn't you?
I did, actually. For some time, I was living in a cave in the Himalayas and sometimes in a riverbank under a tree in a holy place in Vrindavan, which is the place where those who worship God in the name of Krishna,
mm-hmm.
That's their holy place. And that's where I met my guru, Srila Prabhupada. And then, you know, inspired by that principle of integrating a devotional spirit of service in whatever we do. You know, I did many things. Sometimes I cared for goats and cows, and sometimes I lectured in universities. And later on, I was overseeing various projects.
What was your experience like with Mother Teresa? You spent time with her.
I met her a couple times, actually. The first time was in 1971, and I remember something she said that really affected me, because it was so simple but so powerful. When I first came into her monastery in Calcutta, she was washing pots.
Mm.
And and I was introduced to her, and she asked forgiveness that if she could finish washing the pots before we meet, because they needed to be washed. And I was quite moved by that. And then when we did meet, she said that the greatest problem in the world is hunger.
Hmm.
Not hunger of the stomach, because if you give some food to a person, that problem is solved. The real hunger is of the heart. People are lonely. And she said that she sees this hunger in the wealthiest people in the world,
mm-hmm.
as well as the poorest people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
She said the only thing that satisfies the hunger of the heart is to love and to be loved. And the origin of that experience is to feel the limitless, sweet love of God, and to reciprocate with that love of God by showing compassion to others.
Yes. When I think of compassion to others, I think of service. And you have said the highest goal does not come at the time of death. The highest goal comes when we make service to God the highest priority of our life. Can you share more about that, please?
There's a beautiful verse in the Bhagavad Gita that is spoken by Krishna. Vidyadhanaya sampane brahmani gabihastini suni jaiva supa kicha pandita samadarshana. That's the Sanskrit. And the translation could be explained in this way, that when we actually have spiritual knowledge, enlightenment, when actually that love for God begins to awaken in our heart, the true symptom is we start to see everyone with equal vision.
Mm.
because we realize that I'm a sacred part of God. I'm divine. I'm eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss beyond birth and death. That's the spirit within me is of that nature. And when we understand that, when we connect to that, we could really appreciate that wherever there's life, there's a sacred part of God, whether one is male or female, or whether one is white or black or red or yellow or brown, or whether one is from the east or west or rich or poor, whether one is a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Jain or a Sikh or a Parsi or an agnostic or an atheist, or even whether one is a human or an elephant or a dog or a cat or a cow. Wherever there's life, there's a search for pleasure. There's feeling, and there's a part of God. And the more we could recognize that in ourselves, the more we can deeply appreciate it and offer true respect to others. Hmm.
There's something else you have addressed before also, and it reminded me of something that another spiritual teacher shared with me once on this program, a Franciscan priest, Father Richard Rohr. And his concern was the superficiality of the lives that we often lead, and we don't go very deep. And you have addressed this before about living superficial lives can never bring us real fulfillment. As a matter of fact, in one of your articles I read on your website, said, according to statistics provided by the World Health Organization, incidents of serious depression have increased by 50% in the last 10 years. And by the way, just last week, I saw an article on the internet, I believe it was NBC News, that the suicide rates are going up now here in the United States, and that grieved my heart. Can you address this issue, I think, of superficiality and how it does not at all bring the fulfillment that I think what everybody's really longing for?
There's a saying, Richard, that people should love people and use things. Mm. But unfortunately, in the world today, people love things and use people to keep them and get them.
Yeah.
Things could give some fleeting satisfaction to the senses and to the mind, but things can never touch the heart with satisfaction. It's only to love and be loved. That's the nature of the heart, and true satisfaction is a state of heart. Mm. When we speak of things, we speak of physical pleasures, prestige, power, control over others. These are all things. And if we find that peace, that love, that spiritual awakening within ourselves, then we're really seriously motivated to use things in harmony with our service and our respect and our compassion for others. Mm-hmm. But if we're disconnected from our own self in that sense, then we're looking for pleasure, and we become obsessed with finding it in all of these things, and it's very superficial, because ultimately, you know, everything is changing, and inevitably, the death of this body will come. And, you know, what's the real substance of happiness? And that's what great spiritual teachers and philosophers and avatars have tried to remind us of, you know, throughout the ages, that, you know, without a spiritual connection, without a meaningful, fulfilling life, then we're just chasing one mirage after another, trying to find happiness.
There's a beautiful story. And when I read this story, your encounter with this woman at an airport, it was in the front part of the book. It brought tears to my eyes reading this story because I thought it was such a beautiful explanation of what you're calling the journey within. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you can recall that story, if you could share that with our listeners, it's a story about Dorothy, at the airport, and a flight was canceled. And she got very, very angry. And you were sitting over there, obviously looking like a monk. and just staying quiet, but she noticed you, and she came over to you. And what unfolded over the few pages in that first chapter was a beautiful example of how you handled her anger and by the various questions that you asked her. And I think it speaks a lot to what you shared earlier about the most important thing in the world is to love and be loved. And she needed to know that and to understand that better. Can you share a little bit about that story?
Actually, I learned so much from her and from that encounter with her.
Mm.
The flight was late, and she really became apparently obnoxious. She was screaming, and she was just ranting about how unfair this was. And everyone in that departure lounge, I could see, was very, very disturbed by this lady. And seeing me sitting with my Swami robes, she came right up to me, and she challenged, "Are you a monk?" And I said, "You know, please sit down. It's something like that. Let's talk." and when she sat down, I could see that her anger was just a symptom of something that was very, very deep inside of her. And she started to reveal her mind to me, and she, in some sort of tragedy, she lost her husband and her children, and she was all alone, and without her husband, you know, she was cheated in a business deal, and her house went into foreclosure, and she had a little carry-on bag, and she said, "This is all that's left of my life."
Mm-hmm.
She was an upper middle class lady from the East Coast, just, you know, some months before, and then she was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and she said that, you know, she was going to die within a month or so. And she did all this exploration, and there was a particular place in Mexico that they really had confidence that they might be able to help her.
Mm.
But she had to be there that day to take this treatment. And because of the late flight, which was going from Florida to Washington, D.C., she would miss her connecting flight, and she wouldn't be able to make it.
Mm.
And, you know, that was her situation. And I realized that people are inherently good, but because of things that they have to go through in their lives, they, you know, oftentimes that goodness is so covered.
Mm-hmm.
And we spoke for about 5 hours. That's how long the flight was delayed. And in the course of that discussion, I think we were both very, very transformed.
The question that you asked her, and I found myself just staring at that for some reason. You said, "I introduced myself and asked a question I posed 1,000 times. Please tell me what's in your heart." And I found in the simplicity of that question, I saw how that was also so profound, and wondered how many people actually take the time to ask themselves or ask one another that question and then wait for a response.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
Well, because what you're addressing really is I think, the root issue oftentimes to many things. I've come to see in my life and in the work that I do with others that oftentimes it's an identity issue, that we have forgotten who we are. And I believe in some ways, by the questions you were asking her, you were helping her return, I think, back home to who she really, really was. She wasn't really her body. She wasn't really this, really, really that. And so can you speak a little bit about that question, who am I, and how important that question is for people to meditate on, to reflect on?
In my dialogue with Dorothy, you know, we went quite deep into this subject. You know, when we ask, who am I? Generally, we have a superficial idea. You know, we give a name. Well, we could change our name. Or if we go a little deeper, we have, you know, a body, but the body's changing too. It grows from childhood to youth to old age. And we could change our religion. We could change our sex these days. We could change our nationality. And our mind is constantly changing. So who is the witness that is the true self that's observing all the changes of life? And this is a universal principle which so many of the great spiritual paths address as the very foundation to true wisdom, is to understand that I am that living force. I am that, in Sanskrit, it's the Atma or the soul. In the Bible, it is said, what profiteth a person who gains the whole world but loses their eternal soul? And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells, na jayate mriyate va kadachit, that the nature of that living force that's seeing through my eyes and hearing through my ears and tasting through my tongue and thinking through my brain and loving through my heart, that living force is divine. It's eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. It's a part of God, like a sun ray is to the sun planet. It's full of light. And when we uncover the true awareness of ourself, as you use the word, awakened to our true potential, then not only can we find true happiness, true peace, and true love, even through all the ever-changing circumstances of this world, but we could really utilize whatever talents, whatever acquisitions we may have in a spirit of compassion, and our life becomes deeply fulfilling, and that fulfillment is beyond birth and beyond death.
Something else I'd like for you to address, because it seems so prevalent, at least, well, especially here in the United States, I would say these days, many other parts of the world, because of terrorism and so many other things that are going on. You wrote this concerning fear. Fear is the most prominent human quality. It's either behind the scenes or very much in front, motivating people in so many ways. Talk about ways we can transcend fear.
I'd like to just share a very simple example of something I witnessed just last year. I happened to be in Dubai giving some lectures there. And to get to one lecture, they brought me through what they told me was the world's largest shopping mall. And you know, I'm not accustomed to going through shopping malls. I'm Swami from India. And it happened to be a Friday night. There were thousands and thousands of people swarming all over the place, and they were from every part of the world. And there was music blaring, and there's this giant aquarium with sharks and other kinds of man-eating fish, or fish-eating fish. It was quite amazing. And I was walking, and I happened to see coming up an escalator was a mother and a father with about a four-year-old girl. And she was holding one hand of each of her parents. And she was smiling and laughing and dancing, and she just looked so happy. There were thousands of people everywhere swarming, and she was just oblivious to everything because she was feeling the love of her parents. And I began to reflect, what would be that little girl's condition if she was exactly where she is now, but her mother and father were not there? She would have been either hysterically crying or frozen in fear by the strangeness of the situation. What was the difference between her being in suffering and fear, or being completely happy and fearless. It was that she was feeling the love of her mother and father.
Yes.
And when we feel the love of God, which is ever present within us and all around us, then we deal with the situations of this world in our own life and in the lives of others the best we possibly can, but we feel shelter.
Mm-hmm.
We feel shelter in that love.
And that's where the safety is, because that's where the love is. And love transcends fear.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Beautifully spoken. Thank you.
What I'd like for you to talk about is solving the problem of terrorism on an individual level, because you've written about that before, and I would love for you to share with our listeners your thoughts on that. Because terrorism itself is too overwhelming, but each one of us can do something within ourselves to work towards the end of that.
Well, to the extent that we have inner wealth, to that extent we could share that wealth with the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, terrorism is generally a manifestation of an internal state of insecurity, and that insecurity brings about either fear or envy or arrogance. And we have this obsession that we have to feel ourselves better than others.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to feel that my way is better than others, and anything that's different than me or my way is dangerous. Those are due to very serious insecurities of the mind and the heart. And, you know, all the sectarianism in the name of God, or sectarianism in the name of nationalism, whatever it may be, where we feel we have a right to exploit others, to control others. It's the cause of racism. It's the cause of terrorism on so many levels.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a disease of the heart that just comes out in various ways for various people in various places. And, you know, to the degree we could actually, you know, find a stable spiritual foundation in our own life, we can appreciate the diversity within this world. Diversity is actually something very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But if we understand the unity that we all inherently do have, this is my opinion, and one of my friends shared this with me, that, you know, just the word terrorism is such a powerful message within the media and the news throughout the world.
Yes.
And it's almost like a word that people want to be. It sounds very heroic.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps we should not use that word terrorism. Perhaps such people should be called cowards.
Hmm. I would agree with you. That makes a great point. Words are powerful in how we use them. We're seeing that also on the national level here in the United States as well.
The idea that I have the power to cause terror in the world almost gives a certain type of insecure mentality a sense of importance.
Yes.
And I think we should, even with the words we use, we should take that illusion away.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And also, it gets back to the Gandhi quote, be the change you want to see happen in the world, because I know that we cannot change everything, but we can change ourselves, and that is something I can do. But if I'm focused so much on changing the world, it's too overwhelming. But the world can change if I change. And so, once again, I go back to the title of your book. It's always been about a journey within, hasn't it?
Actually, the biggest changes throughout history in our planet began with one person who made that decision that I would change myself. And in God's eyes, it's not the quantity of what we accomplish, but the sincerity of our intent that is actually and truly great.
You wrote something else, and there was a phrase that I absolutely loved. You said there were three basic views of the world. One was materialistic. The other was, well, the world's entirely an illusion. But you wrote that the third is the best view, and that is that the world is sacred property of God. And that phrase, sacred property of God, just made my heart smile thinking about that. How can we help people begin to see that all around us is sacred property of God?
My guru, Srila Prabhupada, he used these words, actually, that we are not the proprietors, but we are the caretakers of the sacred property that we're entrusted with, whether it be our intelligence or our skills or our wealth or our influence, whatever it may be. We can't take anything with us at the time of death. So that means it's not really ours. And, you know, to recognize that everything is the beautiful property of God and to try to utilize whatever resources we have, big or small, in harmony with the love of God and with the compassion of God is truth. It's being honest, to be humble by all the beautiful things of this world. A surgeon uses a knife to save someone's life, and a thief uses the same knife to kill someone.
Yeah.
Is the knife good or bad? The knife is potentially good or bad according to whose hands it's in. And that holds true with everything of this world. We could use technology, we could use science, we could use architecture, we could use everything there is for a divine purpose to uplift humanity and to uplift all living beings. Or we could use it, you know, to satisfy our own, you know, obsessions and cause harm and suffering to others in the process. You know, the earth is everyone's mother. Whoever we are, we can't live for a moment without air, without water, without the grains, without the sun. So to honor and respect that God has given us the environment and all the gifts of the environment is inseparable from showing our love from God, to respect Mother Earth.
Yes.
And also to understand that every living being is equally dependent on Mother Earth. And so in a spirit of compassion, in a spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood, we should try to nourish the environment and avoid polluting her as far as possible.
Yes.
As an act of compassion.
Yes, I so agree. I'd also like to ask you how the world's top institutions look to a man, I'm talking about you, who hasn't had a bank account in 40 years and sleeps on the floor every night for insight on shifting our consciousness to solve the world's problems. And yet you talk to Harvard, MIT, the London School of Economics, Google, Apple, Starbucks, IBM, just to name a few. What are the messages that you're sharing with these beautiful minds?
I don't have really much qualifications. I only had one semester of a junior college. But I'm just so honored and grateful when I could share the beautiful gifts that that Krishna or God and and my guru and the saints of the world, you know, have inspired me to give.
Yes.
My personal appreciation of life, I'm 65 years old now, is there is no greater treasure than the opportunity to serve.
You have a heart for children, speaking of service. More than 1 million children a day in India receive meals as a result of your efforts. You founded free care hospitals, food banks, eco villages. Can you share a little bit about that and about your heart for children? I feel like we all should have a heart for children. There's something so precious and innocent about them.
It's not me. I'm just a part of, you know, many people who are reaching out in this effort.
Mm-hmm.
But my guru, Srila Prabhupada, one time he was in Bengal. This is in the mid-1970s. And he looked from this balcony that he was standing on and saw these little homeless children literally having a battle with hungry dogs trying to take food out of the trash can.
Mm-hmm.
And when he saw this, he cried, because an enlightened person, or a person who's in contact with their own spirit, is paradukaduki. That means the happiness of another person becomes my happiness, and the suffering of another person, it becomes my suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And when he saw this, he cried. And he requested his followers that, you know, wherever we have an ashram or a temple, you know, within so many miles, there should not be anybody hungry. And in India, you know, the greatest reason for illiteracy and children who are in child labor or beggars is hunger.
Mm-hmm.
People would rather beg or work than go to school and not be able to concentrate because of starvation. So, you know, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and other such groups have really gone to give free meals, very, very nutritious meals, within especially the ghetto schools in India. And there are, I believe, well over 1 million children being fed every day now. And I believe the dropout rate has reduced by about 30 to 40% wherever those meals are being served.
That's beautiful. And everybody can do something, can't they? I mean, a big part of your message is service, service from that place of love.
Quantity and quality are both, you know, principles that we live with, and we should all be trying to do good in as much quantity as possible. But what really makes our life and our efforts deeply meaningful for ourselves and others is the quality in which it's done.
Yes.
And every single one of us could do incredible things. In God's eyes, whether we offer a simple flower with love, or whether we offer, you know, a beautiful building with love, there's no difference. It's the love that matters.
Yes.
It's not the thing. And Richard, I write in my first book this example of my own mother. I remember it was her birthday, and I was just a little boy. And like little boys, I forgot about her birthday. So I ran out to our backyard. It was very small. And she had about four or five little rose bushes that she grew there. And I ripped a rose off of her bush. And I ran in and I said, "Happy birthday." And my mother took that rose. And she knew I stole it from her garden. And she took that rose and she put it to her head and she put it to her heart and she smelled it. And she had tears in her eyes. She was so deeply moved.
Hmm.
She said to me, "It's the thought that counts."
Hmm.
It's not the thing that we give to others that gives it value. It's the love in which it's given. Mm. She said, if you would have given me a diamond necklace or this rose, it would have made no difference to me because it's the love that touches my heart.
Yes.
And of course, at that time, I was just glad that she wasn't angry at me for stealing her rose and forgetting her birthday. But as I grew up later, that little simple message that my mother spoke, it became like a seed. And it's the spirit in which I dedicate my whole life to.
Yes. And so you write in your book, "The path I have taken to rediscover love has been what ancient India calls Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of love." The book is The Journey Within, exploring the path of Bhakti Yoga. And for you listeners, I would really encourage you to go to Radhanath Swami's website, learn more about his work, more about these books, also any events that he'll have coming up. The website, and I'll spell your name, RadhanathSwami.com. It has been such a joy and delight to have you on the program today. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
There's no place I'd rather be than with you right now, Richard, and I want to thank all of your listeners, and it's an honor and a pleasure to spend this time. Mm. Thank you.
In closing, here are some words from The Journey Within, written by Radhanath Swami. He writes, "I awoke to the sound of distant temple bells chiming to welcome a new day. Looking into the still dark sky, I rose from the dusty cold riverbank where I'd slept and submerged myself in the chilly Yamuna River to bathe. Climbing out of the river, I sat on a bank in the pre-dawn quiet. As the first golden aura of the sun gently lit the horizon, birds began to warble and coo their morning songs from the forest behind me. This is how I began each day in 1971, when I lived in Vrindavan, the holiest place for bhaktas of Krishna. One day a barefoot holy man stepped out of the forest and approached me from behind, softly chanting Krishna's names. He was perhaps 60 years old, had long matted hair and a beard, and wore the robes and markings of an ascetic devotee of Krishna. He sat beside me and spoke in a hypnotic tone that drew me in. Citing sacred Vedic texts and chanting timeless hymns, he spoke of the mystical beauty of Vrindavan and the esoteric teachings and pastimes that Krishna reveled at the very spot where we were sitting. I felt a universe away from anywhere else in the world. He gradually stopped speaking, and we looked at each other in silence. As I gazed back into his eyes, I was in a state of profound peace. And then he softly broke the silence. I have something for you, he said. I've carried this with me for more than 40 years. It will inspire you to deepen your love for Krishna as it has inspired me. Slightly nodding his head, his gaze still fixed on me, the stranger handed me a folded piece of paper. It was tattered, wrinkled, and yellowed by time. Then he walked away into the dawn. My mind soared with curiosity. Peacocks cawed, parrots chirped, and monkeys screeched as they woke to the morning. Women passed me with brass pots filled with river water on their heads. I tenderly unfolded the paper. Was it an ancient Sanskrit incantation? A secret meditation? The paper was so worn that I thought it might dissolve in my fingers, but I could still see what was written on it. I was not at all expecting this. Smiling, I marveled at the incredible ways of Krishna. It was a familiar prayer attributed to Saint Francis of Assisi in the 13th century. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Throughout my youth, growing up in a village north of Chicago, this prayer was often by my side, inspiring me to reach beyond my human tendencies for a higher truth. Now, in that holy sanctuary in Northwest India, I reflected on how fittingly this prayer expresses the universal spirit of bhakti, the yoga of love. The essence of any devotional prayer, whatever its culture of origin, is to ask God how we may serve with unconditional love. A saint once wrote that it's not possible to describe the devotional path completely. Like a bottomless, shoreless ocean, the subject of loving relationships with the Supreme is so vast that no one can estimate its length and breadth. The most we can do is try to describe one drop. The content of that single drop, however, can flood the entire universe with grace. In The Journey Within, we've discussed a search for our lost love, a love deep within all of us. When we find it, we'll realize it everywhere and in everything. As immortal souls wandering in a mortal world, we've forgotten who we are and our inherent potential to love and be loved by the all-attractive Supreme Beloved. Tasting that love again will be our ultimate happiness, and it will empower us with an unconditional compassion. And that's today's program. I want to thank you for joining me. Also, a reminder, all shows are podcast on the site if you're listening here on 88.7 FM, WICR. And remember, dear friends, rest in love. And so for engineer Kylan Talley and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.